You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Hundreds of Israelis demonstrated in central Tel Aviv against the increasing number of illegal African immigrants in the country and called for deporting them immediately. These protests came several days after the Interior Minister, Eli Yishai, called for arresting all African immigrants and deporting them from Israel. Israeli sources estimate there are 60,000 Africans in Israel from various countries.
Hundreds of Israelis took to the streets to support the call put forth by Interior Minister Eli Yishai to arrest and deport Africans living illegally in Israel. The scene was not free of aggression against Africans in local shops that employ them. The recent crimes and rapes committed by Africans instigated the Israelis to come out in protest. However, Yishai did not reveal the real reason behind his call from the podium of the Knesset.
We are not racists. We will solve the problem of refugees, but we also want to protect the Jewish majority. Otherwise, within a few years, we will find ourselves fighting another independence war.
Israelis are targeting us because we're black and we're Africans, not for other reasons.
We came here in search of freedom and democracy. Then when we came here, we encountered the same problems from the Israelis. But not all Israelis hate Africans.
Israeli organizations monitoring African affairs, especially those seeking political asylum, say that deporting them would risk their lives. And such behaviors is inappropriate for a people that suffered persecution from the Nazis.
Israel is a Jewish state established by refugees, for refugees. It cannot treat today's refugees this way.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Internet radio for smart
Aboriginal. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. Just wanted to let you know, for those of you who are not aware, there is a civil rights, a human rights crisis. There is a human crisis going down in Israel right now. And we do talk about the Palestinian situation here because we do see it as an indigenous issue. And we also talk about Judeophobia when we come across it here. And those who think that there is not hatred against the Jewish population is mad. This is true. But this confusion right now about, you know, race and hatred and ethnicity and territory is getting to the point where we're watching what can only be described as a race riot occurring in the state of Israel against its African population. And I do want to point out, as someone who is in touch with people, you know, in Israel occasionally, that, you know, there are many Africans that are born and raised in Israel now, just like a lot of other ethnic groups that are born and raised in Israel now. And, you know, we really don't understand what the hell is going on right now, especially since Falashi Jews have been in Israel at least since the mid to late 70s. We're really confused here. And the African community in the United States is very confused as to what's happening, because politically, we've always considered ourselves to be allies. And this is a very, very bad state. And I've been on Twitter today, and David Sheen has been on top of this on Twitter more than anyone else I've seen. And we've managed to get him on in here, and he's reporting from Israel. So, David Sheen, welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate you having me here.
All right, so, you know, we have confirmed that you're personally in a safe location, so you're not in any danger. You know, what is going on, especially in Tel Aviv, where we hear that the majority of the violence is going on in the what can only be considered one of the more metropolitan areas of the state of Israel? Why all of a sudden, and why at this point, would people start turning on their African neighbors?
Important question to start from. So as you alluded to, Tel Aviv is considered a bastion of liberalism, so to speak, in the sense that the culture of the city is more liberal. Women generally wear less clothing covering their bodies. As an example of liberalism, queer identified people can engage in behaviors that are, you know, like loving same-sex partners in public by like showing signs of affection. That's something that cannot occur in that many cities in Israel. It's important to say it's like a little, it's a ghetto of the country, but at the same time it's also like a center of industry. So most of the economy of the country is based around a strip of beachfront that is the central hub of which is Tel Aviv. So you would think that it's an incredibly cosmopolitan city, and it is. There's no question that it is, drawing in from European culture and from African culture, from Asian culture, Arabian culture, Jewish culture. If someone grew up in New York City or London and visited Israel, they would be able to find things that they, you know, recognize as touchstones, whether it's like corporate logos like McDonald's, whatever, or just the widths of streets, you know. Like, obviously, it's a very diverse place. The population of Tel Aviv is mainly Jewish. However, there is a section of the city that actually originally gave birth to the city. It's a 1,000-year-old city named Jaffa that is the antecedent city of Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is a 100-year-old city. I'm just giving this back because it's important for Aboriginal people to know the history of the land and where violence is occurring, specifically in this case, in the case of last week, rather, and the last few months, for the purpose of conversation about African people in Tel Aviv. So Tel Aviv history, just to take you a little bit back, is a thousands of year old city. If you're familiar with the Hebrew and Christian Bibles, you'll know it as the city that Jonah came from, Jonah the prophet, from Jonah and the whale. Mm. So people should realize it's a city that's several thousand years old. About 100 years ago, Jewish people from all over the world experienced a wave of migration to this land, and most of them entered the land via the sea, via the Mediterranean Sea, to the Jaffa Port. And from there they migrated into the other parts of the country, but still a lot of people stayed around Jaffa, and then eventually started their own city, so to speak, a place where it would have more Jewish character than the character of Jaffa, which was a city that had a strong Arab character. People were not using, you know, people were using the word Palestine at the very least from World War I, which is what, when the United Kingdom, Britain, became the colonial power in that land and called it Palestine. The United Nations, sorry, the League of Nations actually called that land Palestine, gave it to the United Kingdom to manage as a so-called mandate of the League of Nations. But of course, as people who are Aboriginal people are probably aware, you know, obviously it goes without saying that this is just part of the European colonization of Africa and Asia and other parts of the world that's occurring in that time frame of 100 and several hundred, well, several hundred years. So British people are in charge. They take that land from the Turkish people, or the Turkish Empire, rather, that controlled Palestine 100 years ago.
Ottoman Empire.
That's right, the Ottoman Empire, that's correct. And at that point, from the end of, or, you know, the end of, basically the middle of World War I to 1948, so 64 years ago, it's ruled by the British. Most of the population of the country is Arab. There is a Jewish population that has, you know, been in, it is ranged in population size and in proportion of the population, but it's been, you know, pretty much, as far as I understand, constant for the last several thousand years. And in fact, many of the people that today identify as Palestinian Arab Christians or Palestinian Arab Muslims, or at least a good chunk of them, their ancestors from several thousand years ago were Jewish people at that time, or Judeans, or Hebrews, or you know, Jehovahists. There's lots of different ways to call the group of people that lived in that part of the world 2,000 years ago, Arabs. And I'm going to stop my monologue now, but just I'm trying to give people who are interested in the Aboriginal story of this land just a little bit of like background information, like who's against who, you know, who are these people killing each other, and what's this new twist on the story with Africa?
For most, you know, indigenous people, just to try to be fair, because semantics always a problem when you're dealing with, especially territorial issues. You know, we accept Semite, which includes both Jews and, you know, non-Jews, because we accept Judaism and Islam as religions and Christianity as religions. They have nothing to do with the original peoples there. You know, those are theological separations and cultural separations. So, you know, we don't see a difference between Jewish and other, you know, Semitic people.
Yeah, there's a lot in common. There's certainly, like, I can myself testify to that as, like, a fluent speaker. Hebrew has a much easier time learning Arabic than non-Hebrew speakers because of the closeness of the two languages. So certainly, yeah, there's a lot of crossover there, for sure.
Yeah, we see these separations as cultural and ultimately political. You know, because, you know, sure. You know, we're looking at, you know, colonialism, you know, we're looking at imperialism in terms of, you know, the colonialism being maintained. We understand that, you know, Judaism is just not one body. There are the Ashkenazim, there are the Mizrahi, there are the Sephardim. You know, we understand that. So, you know, we really want justice for both peoples. But, you know, at the same time, you know, without, you know, going into the... Yeah, without going into the Palestinian issue right now, you know, in terms of Africans, you know, there was a point that at one time that most of the Israelis that I've known personally looked at Africans as having enriched Israeli culture. Where this has turned around, I'm not exactly sure. You know, it's extremely strange. But, you know, let's talk about what's been going on with Likud and in terms of Netanyahu, because Haaretz and even the Jerusalem Post is pointing fingers at the political leadership right now. Yeah, what is your position on that?
From my vantage point here, living in the Tel Aviv area for the last few years and a good portion of the last decade or so, certainly in the last couple of years of the Netanyahu government, or the second Netanyahu government from 2009, that there has been an increase in rhetoric or incitement against non-Jewish African people. And you could say, in fact, that it borders on, or if not, actually, let me strike that from the record. It doesn't border on. There has been dehumanization, specifically, of non-Jewish African people. That's my analysis. Certainly, from hearing dozens and hundreds of statements by government politicians, you know, people, government coalition politicians in Israel speaking about non-Jewish African people. I can confidently back that up with hundreds of examples. Maybe not hundreds, definitely dozens of examples, for sure. You have a definite demonization of African people in Israel. It's ramped up in recent years specifically because of the fact that the amount of African people entering Israel in recent years has skyrocketed. That, you know, that goes without saying. Certainly, as long as I've been kind of spending more time focusing on the issue, let's say in the last 6 years, certainly over the past, you know, over the course of the last 6 years, it's certainly ramped up. I remember when people were first starting to arrive as refugees with next to nothing, and that was something that we arrive in Tel Aviv, and in some cases having passed through, or actually I should say in pretty much all cases, having passed through jail on the way here. Whereas, of course, most people who enter Israel don't enter Israel first through jail. Most people who enter Israel first through an airport in Lod, in Israel, right near Tel Aviv. So it's a strange thing for Israelis to experience people who entered the country through essentially the army/prison system. That's something that people haven't experienced in the history of the state of Israel in the last 64 years. So the way that that's played out, I guess it's been reported in other news sources, but the government has had various different policies or ad hoc policies towards these African people coming from the African continent to Israel in the last few years, and it's changed over time. When they first started coming, let's say starting 2006-07, when it just started ramping up, my experience was that African people who crossed the border, which is a desert, unmarked border in the southwestern segment of Israel's border with Egypt, so you'd have these African people crossing over from Egypt into Israel, and because this border is so long and so deserted, desolate, there isn't like a wall. No one's ever built a wall there. There's just army. Sorry, when they send guards or you know, like you'll have army vehicles, a jeep driving along the border every once in a while or so, to see if anyone has tried to cross it in the last X amount of time since the last drive-through. So you have the Israeli army noticing that, you know, they can't stop people from walking over because all intelligent human smugglers need to do is just wait at the border, monitor how often the Israeli army patrols go by, and then just time their bringing of the African refugee or asylum seekers, migrant, to the border at the moment when the Israeli army is not there. That's the way that they avoided having firefights with them in the first few days when, like, or the first few years when the Israeli army was not accustomed to massive migration of African people across their border, sometimes like 150 people a day or more. So all of a sudden, you know, they're noticing these people crossing the border. Sometimes there were shooting incidents in which Egyptian soldiers shot them as they're trying to cross the border. And finally, you know, African people get over the border and they're like, okay, I need something to eat, I need something to drink. You can't send me back to Egypt where they were just shooting me. So the Israeli army didn't really know what to do with these people who just invaded their territory with no weapons and no threatening manners, but obviously in its poverty. So what they did was they put them in jail. And they put them in like some kind of custodial service where they were watching. And at first, Israeli activists did not, like human rights activists, did not even realize that this was the case, that there were jails were filling up with African people. I mean, there's no announcement from the Israeli jail service, or prison service rather, to let people know that this is the case. I mean, sure, it's, you know, perhaps it's filtering through security channels, but the population doesn't know it. At some point, activists noted, they start, you know, kind of making, like talking about it, and then they make arrangements with the government for the government to basically allow them to do what we call, like, I guess in the United States, halfway house service or parole type thing, where, or under house arrest, basically, where they would allow African people to leave the jail and enter a small Israeli village, either a moshav or a kibbutz. Those are two different types of Israeli villages based on financial arrangements, but they're usually generally like a large majority Jewish, like almost all Jewish, if not all Jewish people, Jewish settlement from the last 100 years, a moshav or kibbutz. And these are like small agricultural slash industrial villages to like go there as halfway houses so they could work, have a place to live, eat, maybe make a little bit of money, but they wouldn't be allowed to leave that village unless like a person with authority at this Israeli village would like escort them outside the community. So that was the first opportunity for the mass migration of African people to leave the jail, which was the Israeli response to it in the second half of the 2000s. Sorry, I'm kind of going through like a long history, but I think it's like important to be accurate for people to understand. It's a podcast, it's not like a
How many of these Africans are Jewish? How many of them are ethnically or have, say, maybe converted to Judaism since they've been in Israel?
I would say very low, if any. I haven't heard personally any stories of that. I'm sure like there's stories of Israelification because just by living here, I mean, you talk. I see like young teenage girls that are from Sudan, you know, either were born in Sudan or are the children of Sudanese parents, and they speak Hebrew better than I do, you know, and it's really quite beautiful, of course, to listen to for me, but, you know, I think that it's quite beautiful to hear this language being spoken in a way that's familiar yet also different, but in any case, that goes to show that there is like this process of Israelification, in which African people are fully capable of, if they have the time and resources, be able to integrate into Israeli society. These kids are going, some of them are going to, you know, grade school and high school with, and even university, and even like, you know, master's degree maybe with Israeli people. Of course, we're talking about like a very handful, but yeah, like young people in Tel Aviv, some of them get to go to high school with Israeli kids. In fact, I would say that most of them do. So there is some ability to Israelify. However, to my knowledge, there have been no examples of Africans, whether they be Christian, originally Muslim, or different types of pagans. There haven't been any examples of those people converting to Judaism, so to speak, once they arrived, or those people who already held Jewish beliefs being part of that massive wave of migration that's happened in the last few years. Hope that answers it accurately.
Yeah, but, yeah. I mean, I just thought that was that would be a good point to ask because you know if they however you define Israeli vacation, be it strictly theological, because what if someone is a philosopher Jew from Ethiopia who totally agrees with the revisionist settlers?
I just point. I should just point out that to my understanding. The term falasha is considered like my understanding is it's the definition of it is like strangers, like a term given to the people described as such by their by the outgroup, and so it has a tendency to have a to mean something akin to stranger. So it's sometimes taken to be an insult. So, but if
I think, thanks for pulling my coat to that because in the United States, in the African community, that is the common term. And you're the second person to have pulled my coattail to that because I think that they accept us saying that because they don't really feel that we'll understand what you're trying to explain here. And thank you for doing that because, I mean, for all of us who are listening to that, that is something to understand that, the context of these terms are sometimes so raw. And as indigenous people, we understand this.
I think you said earlier you used the term Judeophobia. Did you use that term earlier?
Yes.
So I think maybe that would be like a way of describing the way that some Ethiopian people, interpret that term falasha as Judeophobic. So in any case, I try to, because there's other terms I feel that like can be used to describe them like Jewish Israelis from Ethiopia. For example, I mean, it's just one off the top of my head that I can think of. But in any order, Ethiopian or Israelis of Ethiopian origin. But in any case, you get what I'm saying without having to delve too long into it. Just about that falasha thing, I know the people.
No, that, like I said, thank you very much, because effective semantics lead to effective communication. This is The Angry Indian, and we are speaking to David Sheen. Reporting out of Israel about what is happening to our African brothers and sisters right now in this mass freak out of fascism that we're witnessing go down in Israel. The basic questions pop up. The same thing that comes up with the Palestinian question, and for someone like David and myself, I'm partially Jewish. What is it when we are watching this sort of racism come from a people who have experienced some of the worst racism in the Western world over generations, centuries? I mean, the church, all of Christianity just sat by while they watched what happened. And after the Reconquista, we know what happened in 1492. They started wiping out not just the Muslim populations of Europe. They started coming after the Jews. And the Catholic Church sat and they watched. And then they said it was okay to do the exact same thing to Indians and Africans. So those of us who are not of what is supposed to be the power structure in the world, and that would include our Jewish brothers and sisters, we have to ask ourselves, why are we coming after each other? And we're going to take a break now so stations may identify themselves, and I want everybody to stick around for this because this is an important subject. We're going into 2012 where mayhem is becoming the norm, and it's just out of hand. This is The Angry Indian, and we're speaking to David Sheen. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Internet radio for smart
aboriginals. So in understanding the particular political and ideological character of Zionism, both in relation to its victim people, the Palestinians, but notably in relation to the Jews themselves, we then come to comprehend the cruel irony of the ways in which the Zionist movement has wrapped itself in the collective shroud of the 6 million victims of the Holocaust, the better to visit upon itself a moral authority to impose on the Palestinian people a fate rather like that of the Jews in Europe. The South African connection is a very old one. It does not merely encompass Prime Minister General Jan Smuts, who is South African delegate to the British War Cabinet, pushed the British government to adopt the Balfour Declaration, making a commitment to construct a Zionist colony under British direction. The relationship between Zionism and the South African settlers had evolved much earlier, because the settlers played a similar role in South Africa as they would in Palestine. N. Kirshner, the chairman of the South African Zionist Federation, provided a vivid account of the intimate interaction between the Zionists and South African leaders, the identification of Zionists like Weizmann and Herzl with the South African conception of a racially distinct colonizing population. As to Theodor Herzl, the founder of political Zionism, he expressed his fundamental commitment in his modeling of the Zionist program on that quintessential colonial ideologue, Sir Cecil Rhodes. As Herzl wrote about Rhodes, "There are differences between Cecil Rhodes and my humble self, all to my disfavor, to my very great personal disfavor. The objective ones are in favor of our Zionist movement. We will only accomplish the Zionist dispersal of the Palestinians by using the methods pioneered by Rhodes. The Jewish company will be modeled on the colonial chartered company of Rhodes, and it will be a great acquisition company that will carry out its tasks through military and commercial means. The poorest will first go to cultivate the soil. In accordance with a preconceived land plan, they will construct roads and bridges and railways and telegraphs and regulate rivers and build their own habitations and drive the indigenous population out."
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for intelligent Aboriginals.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together. Become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
I'm Carol Warden. The Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center asked for your help in spreading awareness of the National Public Awareness Campaign for the availability of Plan B within Indian Health Service. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that is routinely denied to Native women at IHS facilities. Although Plan B has been available without a prescription for adult women since 2006 and as of 2009 available to women age 17 and up, it is still not provided over-the-counter at 90% of IHS pharmacies. Our goal is to ensure that Plan B is available as an over-the-counter contraceptive for all Native women, and to incorporate access to Plan B into standardized sexual assault policies within IHS. We also seek to inform Native women of their right to Plan B, so that they are able to make informed decisions regarding their reproductive health. Please help us get the word out. Native women are entitled to the same level of health care as all other women. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Hey, this is Ra Lamada.
And Donna from EPSI.
And you're listening to a
Creative Commons licensed podcast.
Word.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
This is Nick Gere. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney lied to Congress and launched an illegal war, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge and tortured, used illegal weapons and targeted civilians. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Ask your congressmember to co-sponsor House Resolution 635 for an investigation.
sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Do yourself a favor, get a mind transplant, listen to independent radio, the alternative media in general. This is Ward Churchill saying have a nice day.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginals.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Non-Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. We're speaking to David Sheen, and he's reporting from Israel about the anti-African riots that are happening right now, not just in Tel Aviv. It's actually spreading around the country. And some of I don't know what else to call them. I mean, the settlers, they're now using this as a smokescreen to up a lot of their aggression against the Palestinians that they live amongst. You know, this is a very, very bad situation. But, you know, I want to start asking some deeper questions now of David. When we look at some of the films that we're seeing at the checkpoints, some of the other footage that is coming through of the abuses that are happening by the Border Patrol, we're watching Ethiopians in many cases. Some of them Jewish. I'm not exactly sure how many are not Jewish. And people I have spoken to who have served previously, who did their conscription in the IDF, I've heard that not all of these individuals are Jewish by faith, but they have been, you know, mentally, psychologically, culturally, they've become Israelis, and they see themselves as part of the state, and they have become in many cases just as brutal. And some Jewish former IDF people have told me they are actually sometimes worse than many of the Russian people who have immigrated, who I understand, again, according from reports from Europeans who have witnessed certain things when they've been in the country, that, you know, the aggression that we see against Palestinians by many Africans, you know, now that we see what's going on, you know, how does this play out in day-to-day Israeli politics?
Wow. Well, I think that if I had to break it down for the listener, I would use a word that I learned from a friend of mine, Kunle Bristow, in Toronto. And he describes a situation called pigmentocracy. I don't know if you've used that term before, but it basically describes a societal system, like a societal hierarchy, where the less pigment you have, the more privilege you have in that society. The more pigment you have, the less privileges you have in that society.
Thanks for the education. That is an excellent goddamn word. That is an excellent word that articulates way more than we can encompass in this show. Thank you very much for that.
In this episode, but I hope we unpack that a different episode than your other people. But in any case, cool. But I mean, it, simply put, it means, you know, what I just said. And so when that plays out, first of all, it goes without saying, plays out in all the countries that I've ever lived in, which, you know, whether it's North America or places I've visited in Europe and Africa and Asia, that's certainly the case. Now, it's overlapped with another system of control called ethnocracy, which, belonging to a specific ethnic group, grants certain sets of privileges, and the non-belonging to that same ethnic group means that you are bereft of those set of privileges. So you have two interlocking or interweaving systems of privilege that are, you know, affecting life here: ethnocracy and pigmentocracy. Ethnocracy meaning if you're Jewish, you have more privileges; if you're not Jewish, you don't. Pigmentocracy meaning the lighter skin you have, the more privileges you have. Less. And of course, there's all the other stuff like classism. Of course, you know, this is a capitalist country that's also an effect. So you have all these different isms or rankisms, to speak of all of them, hierarchies. And when you said that, yes, sadly, African Jewish people like Ethiopian Jews who serve in the Israeli army are sometimes reported by Palestinian Arabs as being more brutal than the brighter skin or lighter skinned Israeli soldiers they encounter. I've heard that corroborated by different people, and that speaks to the fact that for African Jews who have a very hard time integrating into Israeli society, in no small part because of their black skin, because of the pigmentocracy aspect of the state of Israel, in order to prove their loyalty or to earn their acceptance into that Israeli society, they play on the card that they have, which is the ethnocracy card, because they are said to belong to the Jewish people. They have Jewish privilege. And so they work. That's a big part, a component of, for many people, it's a big component of how they present themselves. And frankly, it's like what in other times people would say, overseer, in a way, mm-hmm. you know, because you have someone who has slightly more power than you. He doesn't have a whole hell of a lot of power in that society, but has more power than you and uses it to physically abuse you. That would, you know, be one way of understanding it. And it's very sad, of course, when that happens. I can imagine many Palestinian people are betrayed by that. At the same time, it also must be said that it's certainly, from my understanding, it's also very the racism against African or dark-skinned, darker pigmented people in Arab culture, Palestinian Arab culture. Again, this is by no means everyone, just like it's by no means true of everyone in Israeli culture, but it's quite prevalent. There's a lot of pigmentocracy or anti.
As an Israeli, as someone who is in the country, I mean, how do you feel personally to see this type of discord in your society? I mean, with now to triangle it, because, you know, we do have these grays here, as we've identified. We have Ethiopian immigrants who are being brutal.
Some of them aren't. I should point out some are not immigrants. A good portion of the Ethiopian community is young, and they've actually been born here. They were born in Israel after their parents had immigrated from Ethiopia, just to point that out. But yeah, many people are actually born in Ethiopia, especially like if you're over 30, it's quite likely that you were.
Okay, so there is that age gap. Okay, understood. Point taken. So you do have these Israelis, regardless of how to get there, who, you know, we watch them, we see them, they're wearing IDF uniforms, and they're being extremely brutal to the indigenous Palestinian population. Now, on top of that, I want my listeners to understand that there are also African Palestinians who have been in the country for a couple of thousand years. They have an extensive history. We're going to try to append some audio to this interview about that. But, you know, their history has been there. They wear the KFA, you know, they speak Arabic. They're there. And they have been also maligned, not just by the average, and just for the sake of clarity here for our understanding, because I don't want to just label the Ashkenazim like this, but the white Israeli has also, they face racism for them, as well as, say, the Ethiopian who is wearing the IDF uniform, who considers himself to be part of the Israeli society, part of the Israeli culture. Now, to add on to the confusion, we have Russian immigrants that have come in, many of which I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, who do not speak Hebrew, really do not identify with Judaism culturally, do not identify with it ethnically, do not identify with it theologically, who really can't identify with the Palestinian population or the situation. They can't identify with the bias that they receive as Russians, who don't really have a Jewish connection. You know, I mean, like that whole thing that we get into what we understand as Jews being rejected by the average Israeli. On top of this, you know, who don't like the Ethiopians, who in turn don't like the Palestinians, who in turn really hate the black Palestinians. You have all of this hate. And then I also must point out the schisms that are going on between the Ashkenazim and the Mizrahi and the Sephardim, to where the children are not allowed to go to school together now. There are new laws that are coming up to keep Palestinians and Israelis from dating, because obviously they're realizing that they do, that there's a human on the other side of that gate, and that, you know, perhaps maybe I might love you if I got to know you. You know, I mean, you know, all of this. And on top of this, you have the gay movement And you have men who are Arab, who are meaning men who are Jewish, and they're actually finding out that they have something in common with each other. I mean, how do you as an Israeli put all of this together? If you can.
Wow. There is so much stuff going on here. Like you said, I mean, one of the reasons that a lot of people from, you know, who don't live here full time take vacations here is because, you know, partly because of the weather and partly because of, like, it's in the middle of a lot of cultural influences, but partly because it's interesting and you know, because of those cultural myriad of cultural influences, it's interesting. And all this stuff you just described, if you love people, you know, and you care about people and you want to affect people, well, this is the laboratory. And it's the same reason why sadly a lot of the military technologies in the world, like no small amount of them come out of high tech companies that are based in Israel or connected to Israel. So that's like one of the sadder aspects. But at the same time, the urge to fight that military and global military industrial complex drives a lot of people to come here and do solidarity work with oppressed peoples, indigenous people. So it's never boring here, I'll tell you that much, that's for sure.
Okay, so, you know, now that you've said that, you know, I believe that redemption is possible for all people and for societies and for nations. Sweden, Norway, Denmark used to be very violent nations at one point. That they haven't been violent to anybody.
They were going to war 100 years ago, yeah, or 120 years ago, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, they were up and down the European, causeways to going nuts. So, you know, I mean, they have reversed that. Now, Norway is one of the most progressive nations in the world. I mean, is it possible for Israel, the state of Israel, for there to be some sort of understanding to where you can have a Jewish population? And then, like I said, I'm going to be very frank, you know, just be honest.
Straight up.
If it wasn't for the fact that there was all that, if it wasn't for the fact of the whole political mishigas that goes on with Zionism, I just talked about it the last show. To understand Herzl and the times and the Dreyfus affairs, to understand what the hell, why Zionism came out the way it did. But, you know, and what happened afterwards in all of this, it's still colonialism. It's still racism. It's still pressure against, you know, a group of people who really were not wanted anywhere. So, you know, understanding that. As a Jew, understanding that, and understanding that, you know, the Palestinians and all of these other people have to also, okay, you know, I'm trying to be objective here, need to have a space. This latest outbreak of violence and all of the other things that we were talking about, including the new laws that are coming up against women. And again, I want to make it clear here, because I know I'm going on a monologue, is that when we look at what's going on with Hamas and so on, if you really believe that religious fundamentalism is going to bring about some sort of liberation, you're mistaken. So, you know, the women in Palestine, you know, Palestinian women and Jewish women are both suffering oppression under both systems. You know, we have oppression coming out of our ears.
There's no question about that. There's a massive rape culture in Israel, and like, it's not specific to Israel, like the whole Mediterranean basin that I've experienced, you know, has like a serious, and that's not to say that it doesn't exist in other parts of the more industrialized world, like North America. That's certainly the case, but I think in some ways there's less safe spaces for women in Israel in some ways than there are in safe spaces for women in like North America, perhaps. It's not that rape doesn't occur, but I think that there's more of like a... And it's true that the president of the country just went to jail for rape, you know, being convicted for rape on, you know, more than one count of sexual assault and rape, which is, you know, definitely something that should be said in the state's favor as like being a government that respects the rule of law. At the same time, there's no government effort in my humble opinion, very little government effort to stem or combat the rape culture in Israel, which is the only territory it can affect the rape culture in, obviously. I'm sure, as I said, that exists in other countries surrounding this country, but that's not the government of Israel's job to change the rape culture in Saudi Arabia or Egypt or anywhere else. It has to do that in the territories that it's asserts authority in, specifically the borders of Israel, whatever those may be this week, depending on who's in power. In any case, you brought up women, so you got to say, like, there's a lot of that. It's not a safe space. Part of the demonization of African people that's occurred in recent days, and recent weeks, actually, has been, like, surrounding incidences of sexual violence towards women in Israel, and the accusation that it's largely perpetrated by African people. That's extremely far from reality, as documented by official Israeli police data. Extremely far from that, to say that they're responsible for a majority of sexual violence cases. There have been some, because, as I said, this country is rife with sexual violence towards women. As I pointed out, the former president was just in the last year sentenced to jail for rape and sexual assault charges. And right now, from the same town, originally from the same political party, the mayor of that same town where the president lived is also now up on rape charges. He hasn't been convicted, but he's up on charges of rape. So, I mean, and there's, like, it's on and on and on. Like, several mayors in Israel are on charges of corruption, of, you know, pocketing millions of dollars of public. The point is, like, Israeli politicians are rife with corruption, and there's, like, a serious spate of, like, rape culture in Israel that goes to the highest levels of power, whether it's religious power, political power, or just, like, masculine power, the power that men have in society. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is demagogue Jewish supremacists who don't want non-Jewish African people to live in the country are trying to convince the majority of people, with some success they've managed to convince a larger swath of the Israeli Jewish population, that somehow Africans are responsible, non-Jewish African people are responsible for this spike, as they cry it, or wave, or crescendo, or tsunami, or whatever, like, bullshit term they want to call it today. That's the African people are responsible for this, like, spike in sexual violence towards Israeli women. It's simply not borne out by police figures.
Okay.
I'm no friend of police, and police are in Israel are no friend of African people. Okay? But it's not borne out by fact. What it does indicate is that Israeli people, or certain segments of the population, like I said, Jewish supremacists who are against miscegenation. I'm sure that the people who listen to the show know what that means, race mixing, so-called. A lot of people who are Jewish supremacists in Israel want there to be no quote-unquote race mixing or romantic relationships and couplings and matings between, to use clinical terms, between Jewish people and non-Jewish people. And of course, you amplify that with African people. So the mere presence of African people in the neighborhood has been a threat to those Jewish supremacists well before there was ever any financial crisis, when, like, thousands of refugees that weren't allowed to work, weren't given work permits, were, like, left homeless in the city, causing an increase in crime, which obviously, having a population of thousands of homeless people all of a sudden descend on your city, will inevitably cause. There will inevitably be an increase in crime when you have thousands more homeless people in your city. It goes without saying. That's what you have to fight poverty for, to decrease that homelessness level. But in any case, there have been reasons why homelessness and poverty and sexual violence in those neighborhoods that are already impoverished has, you know, also been perpetrated by African people, but it's because of there's a rape culture here, and it's because the African people are poor. They don't have a higher rate of raping than anyone else, or a higher rate of committing violent crimes or any other crimes. In fact, a lot of police statistics say just the opposite, that they're less liable to commit crimes in Israel, despite, of course, horrible, reprehensible, disgusting examples of, naturally, you know, crime actually, yes, committed by
anyone. Yeah, and I want to point out, too, at this juncture, that our Palestinian sisters are not faring too well either in terms of sexual violence and domestic abuse, and that these things are endemic when you're dealing with colonialism, when you're dealing with racism, when you're dealing with social injustice. You don't you can't take out your frustrations on the power structure, so you tend to harm those that you love that are around you. And I'd like to thank David Sheen for taking time to speak with us about this, because this is a very, very touchy and very dangerous subject that brings up a lot of questions that we need to start asking, especially since the United States is headed by a African at this point in time, on how we can have so much injustice going on under his watch and he doesn't address these issues. And I'd like to thank citizen journalist David Sheen for being on this story, and I want you to check him out at David Sheen on Twitter. That's how I found him. He is really on top of this story, so I advise you to follow his timeline and learn more about what is happening with this particular crisis, and hopefully it will end soon. So, David Sheen, thank you for being on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio and taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you for having me here.
All right, please be safe in the midst of all this mishigas. And
I'll do my best.
All right, I hope so.
You do the same. You do the same. You hold it down over there.
You know, but be safe over there right now, because we do understand. I think it's important to point out, because there's a lot of our brothers and sisters and listeners that, you know, I understand. And like I said, the last show we talked about this, you know, anger and how to deal with it. You know, the devil exists. Shaitan exists. All right. But, you know, not in the way that you think. You know, it's a metaphor. Understand it as a metaphor. And understand that not everybody who doesn't look like us is our enemy. And I think enough Jewish people now have gotten to realize that there are some of, you know, the population that do not go along with what's happening. There's a photo, you can find it on aboriginalnews.tumblr.com, of a young Israeli woman who basically saved a young Palestinian boy from being beaten up and more than likely detained by the IDF. And she took a great risk, because anyone who's ever spoken to an Israeli who has stood up for Palestinian rights, you pay a price. And Rachel Corrie paid a price. And I remember her name off the top of my head, but she's not the only one. That some of the most fervent pro-Palestinian activism is you will find in the Jewish community in Israel. And I assume that David Sheen is a part of that, and we need to recognize that and recognize who the real enemy is. And we can't go by how they look, and we can't make assumptions. We have to understand who the enemy really is and what the goal is. And let's actually strive for some social justice and peace out there. This is The Angry Indian, and you are listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Thanks for hanging out with us. Peace, love, and solidarity. And remember, if you want the man to get up off your back, no matter who you are, all you have to do is stand up. Sig it.
Stand up.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
And yet another controversial comment made by an influential Israeli rabbi has sparked fresh security concerns in the Middle East. Here's the details.
The spiritual leader of the ultra-Orthodox Shah's party, Rabbi Obadiah Yusuf, has wished death for all Palestinians and the acting Palestinian Authority Chief Mahmoud Abbas. Speaking during his weekly sermon, the ultra-Orthodox rabbi described the Palestinians as evil people who should perish from earth. He told his followers that God should strike Palestinians with a plague. The annihilation call coming from the political and spiritual leader of the Shah's party, which is also a member of Israel's ruling coalition, received immediate condemnation from the Palestinian Authority.
Absolute outrage. This is not the first time this rabbi speaks in such a way. Almost 2 years ago, he called the Palestinians cockroaches, and this sparked, of course, anger among not only the Palestinians, but also the leadership led by Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, who said that these comments would not serve the efforts of course, the so-called peace negotiations.
PA's chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, has slammed the comments as Israel's ongoing provocation and racism against Palestinians. He says the speech amounts to incitement to genocide and the assassination of Abbas. Rabbi Yusuf's comments come as the Palestinian Authority and Israel prepare for U.S.-sponsored talks in September. Erekat has described such comments as an insult to efforts to advance direct talks. But this is not the first time an Israeli rabbi has called for violence against non-Jews. Earlier, an extremist rabbi co-wrote a book published in 2009, casting a firestorm of controversy. The rabbi said it's permissible to kill non-Jews and Israel's enemies, as well as their babies and children, to control what he calls their evil tendencies.
The irony here, actually, is that the Shas party started as a non-Zionist party, but because they've become embroiled in politics, and because they live on the state of Israel, they benefit from the state of Israel, they get resources out of the state of Israel to have schools of their own, they've become Machiavellian. They've absorbed the Zionist mentality, the Zionist mindset, of which they were opponents in the beginning, and they've become even much worse than any secular Zionist.
With such spread of hate for other religions coming from Israeli spiritual leaders, there seems to be little hope for a Middle East free from violence.
George W. Bush.
That's right.
Look at how many terrorists George Bush has recruited for their organization.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If the United States and Israel had at any time in just the past 40 years, at any time had taken a realistic, honest-to-God approach to the situation that these two countries have caused in the Middle East, and honestly sat down with the aggrieved party, the Palestinians, the Muslims, the Shia, who have been treated like dirt for the past 75 years, and just once sat down and said, okay, look, we've got the power, we can blow you into a million pieces, but all right, let's make a deal. Let's work things out. But no, that's not what we've done. That's not what we've done. And Israel's actions against the Palestinians is the same as America's white European settlers against the Native American people here. We came, they came. We said, God has given us this land. The Israeli settlers said, God has given us this land. And we said to the indigenous people, as the Israelis said to the indigenous people, you have got to move. We set up reservations, they have set up reservations. Same story. Now, what would you do if you were a Native American all those years ago, or a Palestinian all those years ago? What would you do? Would you resist? Or would you say, oh, yes, a master, take my home, take my land, take my water supply, take my village, it's yours.
John, welcome to the show.
Dr. John. Hello?
Yes, go ahead, sir, quickly.
What it amounts to is that you've got no chance whatsoever with Israel at all. Anything that is said or done against Israel is wrong, and the only way that you can do anything with Israel is to agree with them and do what they want you to do, and then you're a friend. Other than that, you're anti-Semitic and you're anti-Israel.
Why do we keep giving them money?
Pardon?
Why do we keep giving these people money?
Because they're the biggest lobby in America, and every single politician, is frightened out of their lives of them because they own the media. Almost a lot of it.
Who owns the media? Who?
And the journalists.
Hold on. Who owns the media?
Who owns?
The media.
The Jewish people that are the owners of the media.
Well, you see, I kind of knew that that's where you are heading, so I wanted you to confirm it.
But look it up.
John.
Look up the register of directors.
John, listen to me. Jewish people don't own any of the television networks in the United States. None. Jewish people don't own any of the big newspapers in the United States. None. Jewish people don't own any of the TV networks in Britain. None. And Jewish people don't own any of the serious newspapers in Britain. None. You see, that's what happens. When you follow your bigoted prejudice, you end up around the back somewhere. I'm afraid the truth is rather more difficult to confront than that, and I'm going to confront it.
Only 28% of Americans believe in evolution.
62% want creation science taught along with evolution in our schools.
44% want creation science taught exclusively.
You are all about to learn that you didn't come from monkeys and slime. All of you were created in the image and likeness of God.
But didn't we evolve from prior organisms?
Yes, we did. Those organisms were named Adam and Eve.
Then why do we share 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees?
The Bible doesn't teach about chimpanzees.
What about redundant DNA, a junk DNA? Does the Bible teach about that?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There's no redundant DNA in hell.
Our children are our future.
Let's try not to turn them into dangerous idiots.
This is Radio Anguindian. Anguindian Radio for the Fourth World.